Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader, with stories from the American West. This is Arizona History. In my readings, we'll focus mainly on the events and characters that shaped our Arizona history and culture. Today, I want to tell you about the Bisbee Massacre of 1883. The Bisbee Massacre occurred on December 8, 1883, in Bisbee, Arizona Territory. It was a violent robbery that resulted in multiple deaths and became one of the most notorious crimes in Arizona's history. A group of five outlaws, Daniel Big Dan Dowd, Red Sample, James Tex Howard, William Billy Delaney, and Daniel York Kelly, plan to rob the Goldwater and Castaneda Mercantile Store in Bisbee. The criminals had previously been involved in rustling as part of the famous Cochise County Cowboys and other minor crimes, but this time they sought a bigger payout. They mistakenly believed that the general store safe held the weekly payroll for the Copper Queen mine. Since Bisbee did not have a bank, it was common knowledge that the $7,000 cash payroll was delivered to the store 1 or 2 days in advance of the company's payday on the 10th of each month. However, they timed the robbery incorrectly and when done were able to steal between $800 and $3,000 and some jewelry and a gold watch. They expected a far greater amount of payroll cash. For this, they killed five people, including a lawman and a pregnant woman. Eventually, six men were apprehended and convicted of the robbery and murders. John Heath, who was accused of organizing the robbery, was tried separately and sentenced to life in prison. The other five were convicted of murder and sentenced to hang. Unsatisfied with Heath's sentence, a Tombstone lynch mob forcibly removed him from jail and lynched him from a telegraph pole in Tombstone, Arizona Territory. The others were later legally executed by hanging at the Tombstone, Arizona courthouse gallows. It all began on the evening of December 8, 1883. The five outlaws rode into Bisbee, tied their horses near the Copper Queen Mine smelter at the end of Main Street, and walked to the Goldwater and Castaneda store. Having heard that a $7,000 payroll for the Copper Queen mine was held for safekeeping at the store, three of the men charged inside demanding the money. Tex Howard, who wasn't wearing a mask, York Kelly, and Billy Delaney entered the store while the other two remained outside. They leveled pistols at the store owner and persuaded him to open the safe, only to find that the payroll had not yet arrived. Angered, the robbers took some cash and a gold watch in the safe and robbed all the employees and customers in the store. Accounts differ as to how much money they stole, but it was reported they took between $800 and $3,000 in cash, along with the gold watch and the jewelry. While the three cowboys were inside looting the safe and robbing the customers, Red Sample and Big Dan Dowd outside the store were confronted by citizens who recognized that a robbery was in progress and began a shooting spree. When essayer J.C. Tappanier exited the Bon Ton Saloon next door, they ordered him to go back in. He refused, and the robbers, armed with Winchester repeating rifles, killed him with a shot to the head. Cochise County Deputy Sheriff Tom Smith was having dinner with his wife across the street at the Bisbee House. He ran into the street and the robbers ordered him to go back inside. Smith refused and told them he was an officer of the law. One of the bandits reportedly said, "Then you are the one we want," and killed him. He fell beneath the freight wagon. Annie Roberts, who was pregnant, came to the door of the Bisbee House restaurant, which she and her husband owned. A bullet gone wild shattered her spine, mortally wounded her. John A. Nolly, a local freighter, was standing near his wagon when he was shot in the chest. A local man known only as Indian Joe was wounded in the leg as he was trying to escape the shooting. Yet another unknown man took a bullet in the leg as he was trying to run away from the shooting spree. Nolly died later that evening, as did Roberts and her unborn child. The whole affair lasted less than 5 minutes, and with cash on hand and seemingly unperturbed, the outlaws left the town at a leisurely pace, evidently unworried about capture. The town leaders wasted no time notifying Sheriff J.L. Ward in Tombstone by telegraph. Ward soon formed two posses, with himself leading one and Deputy Sheriff William Daniels leading another. When Daniels arrived in Bisbee, he began to question its citizens, including John Heath, whose saloon was just down the street from the Goldwater Castaneda Mercantile. Before the robbery, Heath allegedly accompanied Howard and the three other men to Buckles Ranch, about 10 miles outside Bisbee, although no witnesses were later found to corroborate Heath's role. Heath and Howard continued on to Bisbee on November 20, 1883. Heath immediately partnered with a local man named Nathan Waite and prepared to open a new dance hall. Howard returned to the Buckles Ranch and waited with his confederates. Heath and Waite opened the dance hall behind Goldwater and Castaneda Mercantile General Store on December 8, 1883, the day the Copper Queen Mine payroll usually arrived. Heath told Daniels that he knew the men involved and could probably help to lead them to the outlaws. Although Daniels was apprehensive of Heath due to his already having a reputation as an unsavory character, he also hoped to quickly apprehend the murderers. With Heath at the lead, the posse found nothing, and soon accused Heath of leading them on a false trail. Heath returned to his saloon, and the posse continued to search for the outlaws. Although it took several weeks, all five were found, two in Mexico, one in New Mexico, and the other two in Clifton, Arizona. When questioned, some of the outlaws began to indicate that John Heath knew more about the crime than he should have. Soon the authorities brought Heath in and began to question him. Under pressure, Heath confessed to having prior knowledge of the crime, and many believed that he probably masterminded the whole affair. After John Heath was sentenced to life in Yuma Territorial Prison, the residents of Tombstone were outraged. They believed he was the true mastermind behind the Bisbee Massacre and deserved the death penalty, like the five outlaws who had been sentenced to hang. Though Heath was obviously relieved, the citizens of Bisbee were furious and determined to do something about it. Early on the morning of February 22nd, a mob of some 50 men led by Mike Shaughnessy descended upon the Tombstone Jail, determined to take justice into their own hands. The mob stormed the jail and overpowered the guards without firing a single shot. They dragged John Heath from his cell and took him outside, ignoring his protests. Instead of taking him to the gallows, the mob led Heath to First and Toughnut Streets in Tombstone. At the corner of First and Toughnut Streets, they looped a rope over the crossbeam of a telephone pole as Heath continuously claimed his innocence. The vigilantes were not listening. In his last moments, he said, "I have faced death too many times to be disturbed when it actually comes." Without hesitation, the mob hoisted him up, leaving him to strangle slowly rather than giving him a quick drop. The lynching was brutal, and Heath slowly suffocated to death rather than dying instantly from a broken neck. As the rope began to pull him skyward, he cried out his last request, "Don't mutilate my body or shoot me full of holes." The public approval of the hanging was reflected in the verdict of the coroner's jury. It stated, "We, the undersigned, a jury of inquest, find that John Heath came to his death from emphysema of the lungs, a disease common in high altitudes, which might have been caused by strangulation or self-inflicted or otherwise." The other five killers scheduled hanging for March 8th had remained unchanged. Soon taking on a carnival-like atmosphere, free tickets were issued for the event, but when Sheriff Ward ran out of the tickets, an enterprising businessman built bleachers around the gallows and began selling yet more tickets. However, famous businesswoman, gold prospector, and spiritual caretaker Nellie Cashman objected adamantly to the circus that was surrounding the event. Outraged at the citizens' behavior and feeling that no death should be celebrated, she soon befriended the five convicts, visiting them often and providing them with spiritual guidance. She pleaded with Sheriff Ward to place a curfew on the town during the time that the hangings were to take place. Ward conceded, and the vast majority of interested onlookers were not allowed to watch the event. In the meantime, she and some friends had destroyed the bleachers that had been built. When the five men were standing on the gallows, reportedly Dan Dowd remarked that the multi-gallows were a regular choking machine. Unfortunately, he was right, because of the five men, only one died of a broken neck, the other four dying slowly of strangulation. After they were executed, the men were buried in Tombstone's Boot Hill Cemetery. Cashman also found that there was a plan to rob the bodies from the graves for a medical school study. This too outraged the woman, and she hired two prospectors to guard the graves for 10 days, which were left undisturbed and remain at Boot Hill today. The building that was the site of the robbery still stands. Today it's called the Letson Loft Hotel, and it's located on 26 Main Street. So ended the Bisbee Massacre story. Now, in telling the story of this event, there is an opportunity to provide information about Nellie Cashman. Nellie was a highly respected businesswoman living in Tombstone, Arizona, where she owned a restaurant and befriended newspaper man John Clum. In later years, John Clum, who was the editor of the famous newspaper The Tombstone Epitaph, wrote in his book in 1931 about Nellie and the aftermath of the Bisbee Massacre of 1883. I would like to read to you a portion of that publication. Nellie Cashman was a devout Catholic, but her ministrations were not restricted to any sect or creed. It was but natural, however, that her most conspicuous activities should develop in connection with individuals and organizations of her own faith, and opportunities of this character often presented themselves to her in Tombstone. A conspicuous incident of this kind occurred in the spring of 1884. Five men, Daniel Kelly, Omar W. Sample, James Howard, Daniel Dowd, and William Delaney, were under sentence of death for murders committed at Bisbee in the previous year. Sheriff J. L. Ward announced that the execution of these five men would take place at the courthouse in Tombstone, Arizona, March 28, 1884, at 1 o'clock p.m. The simultaneous execution of five men from the same scaffold was indeed an extraordinary event. The murders committed by these men had been unprovoked and cold-blooded, and the death sentences of the outlaws met with emphatic popular approval. The public sentiment was so strong against the condemned men that many were eager to witness their execution. Sheriff Ward had invited as many official witnesses as could be accommodated within the courtyard, but a majority of the would-be observers of the gruesome act were excluded. Inspired by these circumstances and a lust for gold, a brutal-hearted mercenary group leased the adjacent vacant lot and erected a grandstand overlooking the courtyard and prepared to sell standing room only tickets thereon to all who were willing to pay a substantial fee to view the execution. This sordid, barbaric enterprise aroused the indignation of the better class of citizens, but there appeared to be no legal way to prevent it. An outrage upon humane sentiment and common decency was about to be perpetrated, and an ominous suppressed excitement gripped the community. There was sore need for a tactful, sagacious, and determined leader, And at the crucial moment, such a leader appeared in person, in the person of Nellie Cashman. It was in these circumstances that Nellie Cashman interested herself in their welfare and volunteered to assume the role of mother confessor to the unfortunate prisoners while awaiting execution. Only two of the condemned men were Catholics when Nellie undertook her goodwill responsibilities as spiritual advisor. But so sincere and appealing were her ministrations that very soon the other three humbly and gratefully accepted the tenets of her faith. It easily may be imagined how Nellie's great soul rejoiced at this result, and we may not doubt that her gentle and sympathetic influence sustained and soothed the doomed men during their last hours on earth. The unhappy prisoners were greatly depressed when they heard the sounds of the busy hammers constructing the grandstand and realized that the plan was to turn their execution into a public show for gain and gratification of a morbid throng, and thus make the occasion a Roman holiday. Earnestly they pleaded with Sheriff Ward to forbid it, but he bluntly told them that he had no authority to interfere, and it was obvious that for political reason he had no desire to do so. Then, as a last resort, the distressed men confided their objections to their mother confessor. Nellie Cashman's soul, which was a soul of honor, if there ever was one, had been in violent revolt against the impending outrage from its inception, and the fire of her Celtic spirit blazed from her eyes as she listened to the pleadings of her spiritual charges. But even though her eyes flashed, her manner was calm and confident as she replied consolingly, "Please don't worry, leave it to me, and I assure you that not a single foot of the space on that grandstand will be occupied at the time of the execution." And this assurance satisfied and comforted the doomed men because their confidence in their mother confessor was unbounded. But Nellie Cashman had embarked upon a desperate enterprise, one that would prove an exacting test of her tact and courage. In view of the tense feeling prevailing in the community, it would be an easy matter to arouse the mob spirit and precipitate a riot. This must be avoided. Obviously, Nellie realized the dangers that threatened in the delicate situation, for she observed that the utmost caution in the development of her plans, and she disclosed those plans only as their progress made it necessary to do so. Very quietly, she conferred with the chief of police and several dependable leading citizens, to whom she suggested that in view of the suppressed excitement incident to the impending execution, an effect should be made to induce everyone to retire before midnight. This suggestion met with enthusiastic approval, and the result was that the streets of Tombstone were practically deserted by midnight. The next important action taken by our mother confessor was to get into communication with a score or more of her rugged and reliable minor friends, and to obtain their promises to assemble at a designated rendezvous exactly at 2 o'clock the next morning, equipped with sledges, crowbars, heavy drills, picks, hammers, and saws. The men readily promised to assemble, although they did not know what they were expected to do. Promptly at 2 a.m. on that fateful day of the execution, Nellie Cashman was looking into the stern faces of a formidable group of strong and resolute men. Quickly she revealed her purpose to demolish the offensive grandstand. "You lead us to that grandstand and we'll do the wrecking," was the spontaneous response of the men as they caught up their wrecking tools. "Come on, men," was Nellie's curt command as she led the way to the courthouse. Then, seizing a sledge from one of the men, she rushed forward and with a well-directed blow shattered the first splinters from the grandstand. A very busy hour followed. When the dawn came and the throngs were once more astir upon the streets of Tombstone, they discovered that the grandstand had been reduced to a mass of kindling wood and deposited at the bottom of a convenient arroyo. There was no profiteering during that execution. Another thing oppressed the doomed men. There was a persistent rumor asserting that their bodies were to be delivered into the custody of medical students for dissecting purposes. This thought was particularly repugnant to three of the prisoners, and they confided their feelings in the matter to Nellie. "Please don't worry," Nellie said to them for the second time. "A faithful guard will see to it that your graves are not desecrated." And so it happened that watchful eyes saw the five bodies decently interred within the old pioneer cemetery, and just as it was growing dark on the evening of the day of the execution, and on the 10 succeeding evenings, two old prospectors with their blankets and coffee pot and frying pan strolled leisurely away from Nellie's restaurant and disappeared quite unobserved into the gathering gloom of the night. But instead of continuing on a search for treasure, they detoured to the newly made graves of the men who had paid the supreme penalty for their desperate deeds. There they spread their blankets, and throughout that night and the 10 succeeding nights, they remained faithfully maintained the vigil that had been promised to the deceased by their mother confessor. None of the bodies was molested. These incidents prove that Nellie Cashman was not only resourceful in the matter of plans, but that she had the sagacity and willpower to carry those plans to success. Now let's check in with True West Magazine's Marshall Trimble. He's Arizona's official state historian and answers questions from readers of True West Magazine. Here's the first question. Did gunfighters practice shooting? This question was submitted by Tom Klinkensbeard of Glendale, Arizona. Marshall Trimble answers, they sure did practice shooting. They pretty much lived by the gun and didn't want to die that way. Men like John Wesley Hardin, James Wild Bill Hickok, and William Henry Billy the Kid McCarty spent a lot of time practicing. The late Hitchcock biographer Joseph G. Rosa, who died earlier this year, told me that the gunfighter was afraid his guns would not be fight-ready unless he fired and cleaned them regularly, so he shot each pistol every day. Hickok allowed folks to watch and witness, and witnesses wrote reports that he expounded in his accuracy. The next question. Why do airplane paratroopers shout Geronimo when they jump? This question was posted by Pete Snell of Phoenix, Arizona. Marshall Trimble's answer, a retired U.S. Army colonel stationed at Oklahoma's Fort Sill once told me the origin story. One night, Apache leader Geronimo escaped and soldiers pursued him. He ran up Medicine Bluff to a spot 90 feet above Cache Creek, cried out, "I am Geronimo," and leaped off the bluff. By some miracle, he emerged unscathed. Early-day paratroopers who had heard of the legend believed that since shouting Geronimo worked for the Apache, the good fortune would occur when they jumped. Next question. Does cookie refer to cook? This question was posted by Ann Than of Carefree, Arizona. Ramon F. Adams' Western Words lists cookie as one of the names for a range cook. Cook in Spanish is cocerino, so he was sometimes called that, or Cousy. Another name included old woman. The cook was the uncrowned king of the cattle drive camp. Even the boss paid him homage. Cowboys depended on him for 3 square meals each day, come rain, snow, or shine. His deputies included stakeholder on bets, arbiter on arguments, doctor and veterinarian, banker, barber, and father confessor. Most important, he had to make coffee so strong that it would float a horseshoe. Next question. This question was posted by John Wagner, also of Phoenix, Arizona. He says, I know British soldiers wore pith helmets in Africa and India, but why did Mexican Revolution General Pancho Villa wear one? Marshall Trimble states, from about the 1870s, pith helmets were popular with Europeans serving in the tropics. The U.S. Army commander George Crook wore one once while campaigning in the hot Arizona sun, and Pancho Villa did the same to protect himself from the heat. He also wore brimmed hats and peaked caps, also known as barracks covers. And for the last question, who was hired killer Bob Higdon? This was posted by Tom Honeycutt of Fort Smith, Arkansas. The marshal says Bob Higdon was reportedly hired to kill legendary Texas Ranger Frank Hamer as part of an ongoing feud involving Hamer's wife Gladys. Some folks believed Higdon had murdered Cullen Higgins, Gladys' lawyer and the son of noted shootist Pink Higgins. John Bussenecker, who is writing a biography of Frank Hamer, says Robert N. Higdon was born in 1855, was a notorious gunman who lived in Lampasas, Texas. Higdon, who carried his six guns in holsters especially made for him by the noted Texas leathersmith S.D. Mayers. He had a hard record. In 1899, he killed Dow Mullins in Lampas, and in 1915 he was arrested for bribing witnesses in an effort to free his son-in-law from a murder charge in Fort Worth. Lampas's newspaper of the period ranked Bob Higdon alongside notorious Texas feudists such as Pink Higgins, Bob Mitchell, and Sam Denson. This is Michael Shannon, volunteer reader for Sun Signs of Arizona, and this has been the reading of Arizona History. If you missed a program, you can get it on demand at the Sun Sounds website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Scroll down to the programming links and choose On Demand Broadcasts. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device.